Monday night last, our president spoke to a joint session of the Congress. His words rang with a sense of urgency, and his determination had been spawned in the streets of Selma, Alabama. His purpose was to secure, in fact, the right of every American to the vote, and to secure in practice the right of all Americans to come together peacefully and legally, to protest injustice, and to demand a redress for their grievances. In this speech, the president articulated some of the best decency of our national philosophy. Rarely, he said, rarely in any time does an issue lay bare the secret heart of America itself. Rarely are we met with a challenge not to our growth or abundance or our wealth or our security, but rather to the values and the purposes and the meaning of our beloved nation. The issue of equal rights for American Negroes is such an issue. And should we defeat our every enemy, and should we double our wealth and conquer the stars and still be unequal to this issue, then we will have failed as a people and as a nation. The president drew the context of his speech and the facts of life in southern rural America. In Dallas County, Alabama, of which Selma is the seat, there are 14,500 whites of voting age, and 9,500 of these are on the voting rolls. In the same county, there are 15,000 Negroes of voting age, and as of the first of this year, 335 of these were on the voting rolls. In Selma, Dallas County, and throughout the South, the white Southerner has had things pretty much his own way. The Negro has, as the Southerner puts it, so euphemistically, known his place. And the 15th Amendment to our Constitution has been widely and daily disregarded. That amendment provides that no citizen of the United States shall be deprived of the right to vote by the United States or by any state because of race, creed, or condition of previous servitude. In January of this year, Dr. Martin Luther King brought the apparatus of his Southern Christian Leadership Conference into Selma to organize a voter registration campaign. Negroes presented themselves at the registrar's desks, but these officials dawdled. They were open for an hour, perhaps two a day. They could process perhaps one or two applicants a day, and they could always find a specious technicality with which to invalidate the voter with a colored skin. And so the Negro soon took to the streets to demonstrate against this pernicious outrage. And he was met on the streets by official harassment, and as you well know, by official violence. He was successful in his purpose, in that he threw the searchlight of national attention on an outrage which America cannot tolerate in the 20th century. When the president spoke Monday last, he spoke the will of the decency, the basic will of America. America will no longer be patient with the unreconstructed. The federal government will no longer look the other way while those folks back home run back home to suit themselves. All Americans who wish the power of the vote will be secured, that right which is inalienably theirs. President Johnson went further. He spoke the decency, the will of America, when he said that he had lost patience with the pious cant of the Wallaces of our land, who cry out about disturbance, who are so concerned with law and order, who look on every demonstration as intolerable, a turbulence which cannot be permitted because of the public safety. You recall that in his meeting with Governor Wallace Saturday a week, the president, as he himself reported it, reminded the governor that if he is indeed concerned with the public order in Alabama, there is a simple remedy, one available to him. He has only to use the powers of his office to redress the legitimate grievances of his fellow citizens, to speed up their registration, to grant them the vote, and the streets will speedily be cleared, and his cities will be quiet. And the president means business. 2 days after his speech, he submitted to the Congress a strong voting rights bill. And he indicated that he wanted this bill or a stronger bill, and he wanted it now. The bill essentially provides for a standard, simple, uniform registration procedure, which would do away with all manner of highly technical registration form and test. The bill provides that the federal government can organize and staff the registration places if local officials continue to dally, to dawdle, and to find every manner of specious reason not to accept the registration forms submitted. The bill provides that nuisance lawsuits will be prohibited. And finally, that the federal government will supervise the elections when they are held to see that harassment and intimidation and downright fraud does not invalidate the Negro's vote. The president means business, and he has meant business during the entire 18 months of his administration. For during the past 18 months, he has moved faster, further than any chief executive in our history. He has turned the potential threat of a choking off of federal assistance funds to agencies and states which discriminate into a very real threat. Hospitals which refuse Negro patients, universities which refuse Negro applicants, builders who refuse to hire Negro carpenters and plumbers or to rent or to sell to Negro purchasers or leasers, states who refuse to open up their welfare rolls to all equally. All who receive of public tax monies are now required to dispense these and to use these in such a way as to promote the public policy, which is to see to it that discrimination is ultimately erased from the land. And the president used all the powers of his office last summer to secure the passage of the Civil Rights Bill of 1964, which saw to it not only that certain uniform voting regulations were established, sixth grade education was declared to be presumption of literacy, all that a state could require if a man registered to vote. More importantly, that same bill struck down segregation in public accommodations, in the restaurants and the hotels and the motels of the land. He has submitted the strongest civil rights bill ever, the bill which he submitted last week, and he has just these past days federalized a segment of the Alabama National Guard to see to it that the citizens of Alabama who will march on their capital to petition their governor to redress their grievances shall be protected in their march. In a truly significant way, the president's energy in the area of civil rights bespeaks a new energy which we see all about us throughout the land. Powerful men and men of goodwill have moved beyond the platitudes of Brotherhood Week beyond the pious words, to deeds and to citizenship. Employers are not only plaintively claiming their innocence to the general public, claiming that their businesses hire anyone who applies, provided he is qualified, but they are ordering their personnel officers to establish open employment policies, and they are ordering their foremen and their plant superintendents to promote men within the organization, regardless of their color. And we are not only signing fair housing pledge cards because we are grateful that integration is taking place in some other part of the community, in some other block. We were actively campaigning for strong fair housing legislation. And when a Negro moves into our block or into our apartment building, increasingly Americans are learning the virtue of staying put, of living by their principles. Perhaps most important of all, the President's speech of Monday last highlighted a new understanding among us of the meaning of the picketing and the singing and the church rally and the street demonstration, which is the forcing edge of the Negro Revolution. The President, in some very pointed paragraphs, said this: "The real hero of this struggle is the American Negro. His actions and protests, his courage to risk his life, have awakened the conscience of this nation. His demonstrations have been designed to call attention to injustice, designed to provoke change, designed to stir reform. He has called upon us to make good the promise of America. And who among us can say that we would have made the same progress were it not for his persistent bravery and his faith in American democracy?" So many of us have been saying, it's true, the Negro has been discriminated against. Since the Civil War, the Negro has suffered a century of being an outcast outside the full abundance that is America. But why all of this noise? Why these pickets and these picket signs? Why these people parading around our street? Why all these disturbances? Is there not a more genteel, a quieter way to achieve the same ends? Now there are, of course, quiet and gentlemanly ways. Negroes and whites have been meeting in our city and in every city to unsnarl any number of ties in the racial knot. There have been groups meeting in Cleveland this past winter almost daily to secure fair housing legislation in Columbus, to secure a stronger and better organized welfare program for our state, to secure better education for the students in our center city. But ultimately, when massive change must take place in the comfortable habits of a community, ultimately, when legislation must be put on the books to make specific the clear intent of the Constitution, it requires a confrontation. It requires a demonstration. It requires a rallying of public opinion in order for the will to be marshaled, in order for there to be sufficient force to permit the change. In our own city, the gentle meetings, the quiet meetings, have placed books in our schools, but they have not placed a single Negro working man on the federal building project. And it is one of the truths of the civil rights movement that basic legislation has come about only as the result of prolonged and protracted public demonstration which called the attention of the nation, which rallied the will of the nation, which saw to it that our legislators responded to this will. It was the Montgomery bus boycott of 5 years ago which finally struck down Jim Crow practices in public transportation. It was the lunch counter demonstrations in Birmingham 2 years ago which led inevitably to the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And it is the noise and the parade and the violence in Selma which has led directly to the Voting Registration Act which the President submitted last week. and in our own city, where the demonstrations have been far less clear of purpose. Who of us can say that had it not been for these demonstrations, we would have been as active in improving the quality of our education, in improving the quality of our services, in seeing to it that poverty legislation was brought to our city, in establishing businessmen interracial councils, in establishing all the apparatus of human relations which has come into being in the last year and a half or so. Now there are silly demonstrations, and there are careless, spontaneous demonstrations, and there are, of course, suspicious demonstrations. And there are among the demonstrators a ragtag of those who simply cannot adjust to society. And there are a motley of young people who are simply out for a lark. And there are a few who have no love of democracy and would like to mine and to subvert its basic foundations. But in sum, the demonstrations have served a useful purpose. Indeed, they have made it possible for the Negro movement forward to be evolutionary rather than revolutionary. They have made it possible for mores to be bent, for laws to be built so that the Negro movement has taken place within the law, under the umbrella of justice, so that the Martin Luther Kings and the philosophy of nonviolence is still the dominant philosophy of this movement, and not the harsh words and the violent words of a Malcolm X and of those who preach violence and force. Had it not been for these demonstrations and for their success, had the Negro movement forward polarized into opposites of hate and bitterness and violence, the very foundations of our society would be on the block today. So what I'm saying can be simply put. It's high time that we got off of our high horse. It's high time that we got off of our high horse and stopped complaining and criticizing the noise and the embarrassment of it all and the disturbance in the way this or that is organized. It's high time that we realize the high usefulness of these demonstrations, at least of those demonstrations which are the united will of the Negro people, and those demonstrations which win for themselves the assent of men of goodwill throughout the land. Had it not been for these demonstrations, would we have made the step forwards that we have made? Would we look forward to the possibility of absorbing the Negro within American opportunity? Might we not be looking forward to an American Algeria, an apartheid, a separation of black state and of white state, the kind of vision that the black Muslims place before their followers? Who among us can say that we would have made the same progress were it not for the Negro's persistent bravery and his faith in American democracy? Now, most of us have understood the meaning of these demonstrations, and we have understood, as has the president, their legality, their legitimacy, and their propriety. We have been encouraged by the quiet courage, the willingness to accept the blow and not to strike back, the singing confidence of these people, and it has called out from us some of our own decency, the bestness. But I wonder what will happen to this understanding when the struggle is in our own streets and not in the streets of Selma. There is a very good possibility that tomorrow the Negro will take to the streets of Cleveland and begin here a long and protracted demonstration. He has not been deprived of his right to vote in Cleveland, but he is deprived on the federal building project of his rights to employment. And there is a very real possibility that we'll be picking up our newspapers tomorrow night and the days thereafter, and reading black, chaotic headlines, and looking at pictures of pickets who had thrown themselves across the entrance and the exit to this project to stop the trucks from bringing in or taking out supplies. Will we have the same commendation for Reverend Jacobs and the NAACP here in Cleveland as we've had for Reverend King, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, way down there in Birmingham, in Selma? What are they protesting about? Newspapers tell me that one Negro journeyman in the five major building unions is at work on the federal project. And for 3 years now, the civil rights groups in our city have protested the closed unions, which effectively prohibit Negroes from getting the union card, from going to work. Recall that in the summer of 1963, we had a series of confrontations over employment on the addition to the public auditorium under the mall. And there have been innumerable meetings between employer and union and the civil rights groups and the government. But of tachlis, substantial result, there's been precious little. And so the Negro will take to the streets to protest another indignity, to protest the use of tax dollars to sponsor the economy, to make the economy more healthy in such a way that he cannot have his share of the opportunity so being built. The Civil Rights Act of 1964, there was a provision which established a governmental blacklist of contractors and employers who had bid for government jobs and been awarded these, but who in their hiring for the job so awarded, blacklisted Negro employers, Negro workers, or refused to hire them. The clear intent of the law was to establish open hiring as a basic policy for the expenditure of public funds. But in practice, the employers could do very little. They must hire union people, and the unions themselves have apprenticeship tests and journeyman tests, presumably qualification tests, which allow them effectively to deny the union card to those to whom they wish to deny it. And these qualification tests serve exactly the same function as the literacy tests used to serve the registrars of the South. Whom the registrar did not want to enroll, he failed. Whom the union does not want to pass, the union fails. And so essentially the Negro is taking to the streets to insist that some kind of governmental pressure in the form of statutory legislation or of administrative decision come into being, which will see to it that the clear intent of the national will in matters of public expenditure be in fact established, and that the charade which is now being played, where the government orders the employer to hire anyone, and the employer says, I will hire anyone, but I can only hire those who are offered to me with union cards, and the unions say, you can take anyone from among us, but there is no Negro who can pass the test. Where this complicated charade is cut through, where a situation is established, which will indeed and in fact guarantee to the Negro his right to such employment. Now in Selma, the focus was on the right to vote. But obviously the purpose of the demonstration in Selma was much larger than the desire simply to enroll the voters of that city. The civil rights movements wanted to establish law which would then force the registrars of all the counties of the rural South to open their booths and to put the Negro onto their rolls. The focus in Cleveland is on employment. But the purpose of the demonstrations in Cleveland, if they indeed take place, is far larger than the employment of two or three or a dozen Negro working men in one federal project. The Negro is taking to the streets to force the government to create a situation, administratively or legally, which will in fact grant to the Negro his right to be employed in these various trades. And if only a few Negroes are at the end of all of this turbulence employed in Cleveland, that is not the point. A few more will be employed in another federal project in another city, and a few more in another federal project in a third, until gradually the Negro will have had open to him another aspect, another segment of our economic opportunity. And what of those who say that disturbance breeds disturbance? And what happened in Collingwood this last week happened in part as a direct result of the black headlines and the gory TV clips which we saw about the truncheons and the tear gas and the beatings of the South. Perhaps so. But must we not take for ourselves the truth which the president spoke to Governor Wallace? If we want peace in our city, if we want quiet on our streets, there's a very simple way. Let us redress the grievance being protested. The fault lies not with the Negro. The fault lies with the economic order of things. And if we are concerned with peace and order, if we are concerned with the security of our city, if we want to move forward beyond this shuffling and this bustling and this violence to a better community, to brotherhood, then we must put the pressure upon the employers and upon the unions and upon the city government so that we break through this present impasse and find ways to achieve for the Negro the rights which in this case are legitimately his. We celebrate today the festival of Purim. Purim commemorates an ancient deliverance. And the history of Purim is a simple one. Queen Esther was willing to demonstrate before the king in behalf of her oppressed people. She called to the king's attention an outrage which Haman was about to perform. And the conscience of the king was moved. And he ordered that Haman's life be taken in lieu of the life of the Jew. On such a holiday, it is well for us to review in our own minds our attitudes towards demonstration in behalf of justice. We ought not to complain, but to approve. If there are pointless demonstrations, they can be overlooked. But the point of these demonstrations must never be overlooked. They have made it possible for the Negro to come closer within the framework of and context of our democracy to his rights. They have made it possible for all of us to look forward to days beyond the present racial struggle, when indeed we will have moved, as our Megillah says, Yagon l'simcha, me'evel l'yom tov. Turbulence to joy, and from heartache to a secure nation. Amen.